Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and this is the second of two parts about the history of mandated boarding schools for Alaska Natives. My guest is Reverend Dr. Michael James Alexa, who has written several books on Alaska Native culture and history. In this episode, the Tlingit fight back through petitions and letters.
First of all, the literate Tlingits, the ones who were at the Russian Bishop's House School, they wrote petitions. They wrote petitions in Tlingit and in Russian. They sent letters to President McKinley in 1895. The one petition I remember translating years ago, they had 3 points. They said to the president, we don't want the governor, who was John Brady at the time, putting a road through our village. I think it's Catalan Street today. He went through the graveyard and threw the bones of our ancestors into the ocean. And if the governor can do this, other folks are going to do it, and we're going to lose all control of our own community. So we think as a first step, the governor should not be allowed to put a road through the village any old time he wants, any place he wants. Secondly, we have the Baranov and other packing companies, canneries, taking away all the fish. There's no escapement. The land that we think as clan members that our clans own, that we Tlingit have controlled for centuries, we always allow for some escapement, otherwise there'll be no fish in the future. But these canneries are taking everything. First of all, they should ask our permission. It's still our land. And secondly, this kind of fishing should be outlawed. A really good point for Tlingit chiefs of 1895. And lastly, we don't want any liquor stores. We think saloons are evil, and they destroy culture and families. And we don't want, this is almost with a tongue-in-cheek spark of sarcasm, we don't want the civilization that does not close but promote such businesses, because all this is poison to us, and we wish the president would intervene and put a stop to it. So Tlingit chiefs, there's about 9 of them who signed in Tlingit, in the 1890s, who knew exactly how to go about protesting what they thought was unfair, and they went to the top. They went to the president. The Aleut people, who were the majority in Sitka at the same time, wrote a petition to the Russian ambassador. They said, under the Treaty of Sale, we're supposed to be citizens in this country, but our rights are being trampled upon or ignored, and we've gone to court and sued, and we cannot get satisfaction. So we want the Russian government, this is 30 years after the transfer, we want the Russian government to set up an inspector here in Sitka to monitor compliance with the Treaty of 1867. So they didn't take any of this lying down. The literate, articulate Alaska Native people, both Tlingit and Aleut here in Sitka, were doing their best to stand up for their rights. But the courts decided, you're not citizens, so we don't have to listen to you. And then they didn't really become citizens until the Native American Citizenship Act of 1924. But until then, political leaders could ignore the petitions and pleas of the Alaska Native people because they couldn't vote and they weren't citizens anyway.
And then things changed and the boarding schools continued, but started to pop up within Alaska.
Carlisle Indian School, there are Alaska Natives there already in the 1870s. So a few years after the sale of Alaska, the transfer of Alaska to American rule, there were already Alaska Native kids being sent all the way to Pennsylvania. And they were dying there, because the record is in the cemetery. Their tombstones are inscribed Aleut, Eskimo, Alaskan Native, or Alaskan Indian. So we know, but there's no birth dates, so we can't tell how old any of them were, but they were already certainly being sent as far away as Pennsylvania. I would say, on the whole, though, the boarding schools continued to gain more and more enrollment, especially after World War II when Edgecombe was opened. So until then, boarding schools meant leaving the state after World War II, after Edgecombe, 75 years, I think, this year. After Edgecombe was opened, they had the option of at least staying in Alaska to go to high school. But you have to remember there were no high schools anyplace else. Schools in the villages only went to 8th grade, and that was considered sufficient. Only a few religious boarding schools existed. specifically St. Mary's on the Yukon for Roman Catholic kids. And there were orphanages, they called them, that were also functioning as schools. But by and large, Alaska Natives, if they wanted to go on beyond eighth grade, had to leave the state until Mount Edgecombe High School was started. And well into the 1970s, enrollment was not a problem. The problem was that so many of the alumni, either those who had dropped out and never really finished, but even those who had, were not doing very well. They were depressed. They were angry. They were embittered. Many, of course, I can't say this about the majority, but many, at least you can easily say many, especially those who didn't succeed in the boarding schools, who dropped out and went home, felt they were failures. And those who did succeed often felt alienated from their own communities. They spoke English better than anyone else, but they spoke their native language, as one of my friends said, like children. Their fluency in their own language had declined while they were in boarding school, while their fluency in English increased. So they became, you know, somewhat, well, torn, that, you know, we understand the outside world, but we'll never really fit in there very well. I mean, think of it. You're a student at Edgecombe in the 1970s. They brought you here. You have 4 years of schooling. You have a high school diploma. You know the presidents of the United States by memory in the proper order. And then you go home and begin reciting that to your elders, who have no idea what you're talking about. And even if they did, find this information completely irrelevant and useless. But then where are you going to go? You want to come back to Sitka and get a job? You don't know how to do that. They never taught you that in school. That put people in a horrible psychological and spiritual condition. And people drank, and people got depressed, and especially young men got involved in dangerous, they call it accidents, but it was almost suicidal behavior. And then there became more and more an epidemic of village suicides. And people start, wait, where's this coming from? We didn't have this problem 100 years ago. We have in the archives of Protestant missionaries coming to Alaska, that while it was cold and dark and often depressing in rural communities in Alaska, suicide was unknown among them. And 100 years later, it's an epidemic. So something clearly went wrong, and it didn't take too long for people to connect the dots and say, maybe taking kids away from their homes for years at a time, teaching them that everything they've learned until now was wrong, evil, barbaric, or savage, teaching them that everything we've got is the right way, but you'll never have it. I mean, doing that to 3-4 generations of human beings is going to have a highly negative effect. And so since the state had the money, and since they were sued, in any case, they decided to build high schools in every village, which may not be cost-effective even today. But nevertheless, it's far better to have kids through the age of 18, I would say, home with their parents and in their home communities than it is to take them away and institutionalize them, especially since those institutions were, in my opinion, run more like prisons. I worked at Edgecombe as a volunteer, but I worked at Wrangell Institute regularly. And the discipline there was about the same as you would find in any incarcerated situation. The children had no privacy. Their mail was opened and read. Their money was confiscated. They had to do everything as a group, get out of bed together, take a shower together, eat your meals together, march in single file to your classes. They were treated as if they had committed some crime, but the only crime they had actually committed was being born Alaska Native. And to make that into a crime is, well, horrible, dehumanizing, and ultimately destructive of the very children we're trying to educate. And I think the state kind of came to that conclusion. We should also admit, however, some of the best and brightest Alaska Native leaders were those also who came out of those same boarding schools, because they came to understand the dominant culture's way of doing things, and then were able effectively to interact with it for the good of their own people. Otherwise, we probably would have never had the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and to wrap up, we talked about the state of the boarding school today.
Well, there were boarding schools that you could say tried to do it the right way. There were boarding schools that allowed the native language and encouraged the culture. But even there, removing teenagers from their loving, caring, supportive adult network was damaging no matter what you did. It's taking the kids away from home at that age. To take 13, 14, and 15-year-old kids away from their parents and grandparents and the nurturing and the supportive context of the village has proven disastrous for so many hundreds of kids. I talk about this with my own teenage class at the behavioral hospital in Anchorage. You start your schooling career with 10 kindergartners. They're supposed to all graduate 13 years later from high school. On the average, if you had 10 kindergartners in that class, how many would actually probably graduate? It's less than half. Three or four, maybe five. But out of the 10, where did the majority go? They dropped out. How many of them are healthy? Well, not many. They've got drug and alcohol problems. They've got depression problems. How many of the 10 have already died? And it'll be two or three from every group of 10. So when you graduate four of the 10 you started with, and the other six are either in prison with serious depressive or addictive behaviors, or have died, there's something seriously wrong. And I say to them, well, let's do the hypothetical class of, 1995. How many of them, how are they doing? They should have graduated by now, but how many actually graduate? It's a minority. Most of them didn't graduate. And what happened to those who dropped out or what? It's not a happy story. Year after year after year. And that's still true today, you see. Take the kids out of the village, the statistics will become even worse. The real problem, in my opinion, is that we have to have a curriculum in the village schools that's relevant to that community. We should be training kids to open businesses or to become productive members of the village in which they were born because they have no ambition of going any other place. And we don't make that possible. The curriculum of the school is aimed at getting them out of the village, even today, hopefully getting them into college, getting a post-secondary degree, and getting a job somewhere else. It's still the mentality. The best thing for the village kid is to leave the village, when most of them don't want to leave the village. Their parents don't want them to leave the village. But the school, the mentality or the philosophy behind the school curriculum is still get out of town. I ask the teachers in my own village, when do you consider yourself successful teachers? When your graduates stay here or leave? They unanimously said when they leave. Then I asked them, well, then how many actually leave? Well, two or three. And how many of them leave and succeed? Seldom. So we're setting them up for failure, and we blame the kids. No, we need to have a curriculum that meets the needs, the desires, the aspirations of the people. And that requires local control. The village parents and grandparents and elders deciding what they would like to see their kids learning. And they all, by the way, want them to learn English and become literate in a global language like English is, and have a successful, healthy interaction with the world beyond their community. But they also at the same time want them to feel proud of who they are and where they were born and their history and culture and language. I don't see why we can't have both. But we've made it an either-or proposition for over 150 years, and it hasn't been a happy story so far.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.